Welcome to Voices of the Valley, a captivating podcast series that brings together some of the brightest minds in the agriculture industry. Straight from the field to your living room, we explore the challenges, innovation, and triumphs in modern-day farming and provide insight for consumers who are curious about where their food comes from. Welcome to this week's Voices of the Valley. I'm your host, Corey Lundy. Did you know the superorganisms that we call bees pollinate an estimated $15 billion worth of crops in the U.S. each year, including more than 130 types of fruits, vegetables, and tree nuts? And here's another fun fact you can share at your next social gathering. A single bee produces a 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey during its lifetime. In this week's podcast, we join Western growers Kara Timmons and Gina Cadby and special guest Katie Chiapuzio, Director of Environmental Sciences and Resources at Braga Fresh, to discuss the wonderful world of bees, why these pollinators are beneficial for agriculture, and how growers like Braga Fresh are implementing various sustainability practices to support the bee population. Over the last 95 years, Braga Fresh has established itself as a leader in the fresh produce industry. A grower of 38 vegetable commodities in Salinas in the Imperial Valley, Braga Fresh is leading the way on sustainability and biodiversity initiatives in agriculture. By the end of this podcast, we hope you gain a deeper appreciation of bees and the growers who work with these pollinators, and a better understanding of the critical role they play in agriculture through crop pollination, increased crop yield, and crop diversity.
Hi, my name is Kara Timmons. I am the communications manager from Western Growers. Welcome to Voices of the Valley.
And I'm Gina Cadby. I'm the environment and climate director for Western Growers.
Today, we have Katie Chiapuzio. She is the Director of Environmental Sciences and Resources at Braga Fresh. And while Katie has a lot on her plate, today we are specifically talking about bees.
Welcome, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about Braga and what you folks produce?
Sure, yeah. Braga Fresh is a cool season veg producer out of the Salinas Valley. We've been farming for about 95 years now, starting in dairy cattle and then moving as the Salinas Valley shifted, and now we're doing 38 commodities of cool season vegetables. We grow in the Salinas Valley as well as the Imperial Valley, and we have been kind of leading the charge in this area on sustainability initiatives. So we're really big on integrating any sort of sustainability initiative and biodiversity into our farms to allow us to rely less on inputs and more on the, you know, native biodiversity that exists in the area. So one of the ways in which we do that is by implementing all of this habitat on our farm. So we have several acres of permanent habitat as well as habitat on our borders and an apiary.
So how did bees find their way onto Braga Farms? Because bees are not native to the area. So how did that happen?
Yeah, so when I was hired with Braga about 4 years ago, I had a history in apiculture, and it was something that I didn't really want to leave behind. And so when I was offered the role that I have now, I was told that I could actually bring my bees with me. And so I started with about 4 hives on our home ranch, and as I started to bring them over to our seed crops that we were pollinating and really start to use them in the operation, they gave me the permission to add more. And so now we have upward of 15 hives that we move around our different ranches as we're pollinating our seed crops and establishing our beneficial habitats. And that's kind of, it was a package deal. They came with me.
BYOB, I love that.
What do bees do for agriculture, and how important are bees to our agriculture system?
Yeah, so it really depends the agricultural system that you are referring to. So obviously, if we have things like tree crops, almonds, citrus, bees are directly pollinating those crops. And so I think that industry, the value of bees in the pollination industry in the U.S. is about $15 billion worth of crops that are pollinated by bees. If you're talking about things like cool season veg, like we grow in the Salinas Valley, bees are pollinating our habitats, they're pollinating our seed crops, but they're not directly pollinating our cash crops.
How do organizations like Braga in the push towards sustainability integrate bees into this plan and this system?
Yeah, so at Braga, we actually manage an apiary on site. So I manage about 18 hives of honeybees on our home ranch and some of our other ranches in the Salinas Valley. So the reason that we do that is because we have ample habitat in our ranches, and we need to keep that habitat blooming year-round. And so we use our bees as supplemental pollination for this habitat that's then going to support beneficial insects into our crops. We also try to integrate native habitats so that we can get native bees and native pollinators also thriving in our area. When you have a really fragmented landscape, such as the Salinas Valley, where you have all of these monocrops all around the valley, you've taken away a lot of habitat. But we want to integrate that and reintegrate that into the valley so that these pollinators that existed here once can stay here.
So what does it mean to have a healthy bee? What does a healthy bee look like?
Oh, geez. a healthy bee is flying alive, generally. No, I would say it's more about a healthy colony than it is about a healthy individual bee. So bees are actually seen as superorganisms. So as opposed to looking at even one box of bees, you want to be looking at your entire apiary and managing the health just like you would with a crop field. You're not going to manage for one plant, you're going to manage for your entire field, right? And so for me, I guess the indicators that I look for is activity. You want to make sure that your hives are moving on warm days. You want to see a lot of activity. You want to see bees coming in with pollen on their legs. They're all dancing into the hive. You don't want to see any sort of like physical ailments. So sometimes you'll see a bee with disease and it'll have wings that are, you know, not formed all the way, or it'll be moving really slowly. And so it's really about just looking at your hive as a whole and making sure that you're not seeing anything crazy. You don't want to see any mold or any sort of weird behaviors.
You mentioned dancing bees. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So bees have a very kind of cool way that they communicate with one another. One of those ways is this little dance. It's like a little figure eight that they do. And what they're doing when they're doing this figure eight is they're indicating what direction other bees should fly and what they're looking for. So generally, if a bee, let's say, chooses a California poppy and sees a really good patch of California poppies that has a lot of pollen, nectar, and resources that they need, what they'll do is they'll bring back a little bit of that pollen so that the other bees can smell it. And then they'll indicate with this little dance which direction the bees should fly in to go get that resource. So as a colony, they're going to come back and say, okay, this was a really good resource, let's all go there. And then when they, you know, take all the pollen and nectar from that, they'll find a different resource and they'll all focus on that. So it's this really effective way to get the whole group, you know, taking the same resources and then moving around. Whereas if you find a flower that isn't producing a lot of pollen, they're not going to indicate that you should go in that direction.
Are there other examples of high level of communication between the hive?
Yeah, absolutely. So bees mostly communicate through pheromones. And so people often ask, why are bees swarming in the spring? And the reason the bees are swarming in the spring is because the pheromones indicated that they should be leaving. And so swarming is actually like a reproductive activity that they do. And the reason that they do it is the queen is in the colony. It's getting really, really crowded. She can't really control the hive as she could before. And so her pheromones are not distributing the way that she wants them to. And she starts to get ready to leave. And so the worker bees will then start to create princess bees. So they'll usually do 10 or 15 cells that they're turning into princess bees. And then once those princess bees are capped and starting to pupate, about half the colony will actually leave with the queen to go find a new place. And then when they're out, obviously her pheromones need to be, you know, communicating in open air. And so she has these really strong pheromones. She's keeping all of these bees really tight together. And then she's sending scout bees out to find a new place to live so that they can develop their new colony. And so they're actually splitting their population and expanding their colonies. Like I said, they're a superorganism. So instead of, you know, like reproducing, they're actually fully creating new families.
Are there a couple examples you could give where listeners might be able to identify what kind of bee they're looking at in their own backyard?
First, we should focus on, I guess, what you're seeing in your yard. So what you're seeing in your yard is a worker bee. So there's three different castes of bees in a normal hive, and that would be a worker bee, a drone bee, and then a queen bee. So the worker bee is probably the only honeybee that you've ever actually seen because it's the only one that leaves the hive on a regular basis. So the worker bee is just the typical honeybee that you've seen, probably what you've been stung by. The drone bee is bigger and has eyes that look like a fly, and he's more fluffy and bullet-shaped rather than this pointy shape. And then a queen bee is the largest. She's very elongated because she has a spermatheca and she holds all of her genetic material for the entirety of her life. And so she is kind of this golden bee. She's always a little brighter than the rest of the bees and just a little bit bigger. And so females are queen or worker, and males are called drones. As far as like differentiating the subspecies, it's really challenging. I would say generally Russian bees are darker in color. Apis mellifera, or the Italian honeybee, is generally like a more golden bee, but they all look pretty similar.
So you talked a little bit about bees as pollinators, right? And how they do pollinate crops, but also when they're bringing that pollen back to the hive, what does that look like in terms of, you know, we think that maybe they just need one food source, but the diversity of having that pollen around, like how important is that?
So it's actually really cool. So when you open up a hive, like a managed box, a Langstroth hive, so they're those square boxes you often see stacked, and you go in and you pull out a frame, you'll see that the bees use all sorts of different types of pollen. So generally, they choose their pollen based on what's available. And so if you have a monocrop, sure, they're going to take all the pollen from your almonds, they're going to take all of the pollen from your citrus, whatever it is. But when you have a diversity of pollen and diversity of habitat like we do in the Salinas Valley, you often see that they're actually picking and choosing. And so when they go to distribute and deposit that into the colony, you'll see all these cool different colors. And you'll also see it when they're flying in. So on the back of their legs, they hold these pollen sacks. And you'll see like yellow pollen, you'll see orange pollen, you'll see purple pollen, black pollen. It's super cool to see all these different species that they've actually gone to. Whereas when you're in more of a dearth, you're going to see that all the pollen is the same color and they're going to what's available to them. But it is super important to make sure that when you're maintaining a colony, you're maintaining habitat and you're maintaining also forage and food year round. So it's super important to make sure something's always going to be blooming, or else they're flying out and they're coming back empty handed, right?
I know there's a lot of research that's been done on what is harmful to bees and what's not harmful to bees. And my understanding is a lot of this research is specifically done on honeybees as opposed to native bees or other types of bees. So what do we need to be thinking about when we're thinking about general bee health that maybe isn't as well researched, or things that we could think about a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that that's a common misconception as well. So honeybees are actually not on the endangered species list. As a species, they're doing very well. There was a time in around 2006 where they were declining rapidly. And so that kind of started this massive worry about bees, right? And as you said, a lot of the research is done on honeybees because they're docile and they're easy to quote unquote domesticate, right? Not as easy to do with solitary bees or bees that just, you know, are more aggressive or different behaviors. But I would say in order to support all bee species, it's really important to just understand that they all have different needs, but it's pretty basic. They're like us. They need food, they need water, they need habitat. And so if you can provide food, water, and habitat in your yard or in your operation or outside your building, anything that you can do to make sure that, you know, especially where we take it away, that we're supplementing and we're adding more back, I think that that's an easy way to support bees that anybody can do. Honeybees in particular, unless you're looking to manage colonies, definitely focus more on the flowers. But native bees, it's really know what's native in your area and try to build your garden out with things that'll support them year round.
I understand that you've done a lot of work with Braga since you've come on board with creating wildlife habitat and kind of making that space. How have you seen that space transformed since you started that?
Yeah, so when I started with Braga, they had already been implementing a lot of these like habitat initiatives. And so they had acres set aside for habitat. But getting with our grower and our sustainability team, we recognized that there were places where we had biodiversity that may not have necessarily been functional biodiversity. And so as we've gained more bandwidth and just kind of thought about it more, we've been really trying to work on a shift toward making our biodiversity function for the purposes that we're looking for. So one of those purposes being to foster healthy hives. And so one thing that we've done is recognize that our honeybees are coexisting really well with the native bee populations in the area, but we want to continue to foster that growth and foster that coexistence. And so we've actually tried to integrate a lot more native plants into our habitats. There's a couple plants that are really, really well known in this valley to be like bulletproof. They're not going to harbor pests, such as alyssum or dill or cilantro. So we've been integrating that for a very long time. However, we've been trying to increase our natives. And so we've worked on some blends where we're integrating 50% natives. It's costly and it's been challenging. A lot of low-growing things like clover that are more easily accessible, California poppy, phacelia, all sorts of really accessible native plants. But we're kind of starting to look into maybe getting more permanent, like you know, coyote brush and things that can exist year round, start some hedgerows so that we can really, really make sure that we keep that biodiversity on farm.
You had talked about, you know, what people can do for bee populations in their own yards. And I know that Braga, you've talked about having kind of patches or islands where it kind of gives the bees and other insects, beneficial insects, a place to go so they're not, you know, exhausting themselves. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how, and what that can mean in someone's own yard?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is super important. So as we integrate habitat and we have all of these acres devoted to habitat, we also need to make sure that these beneficial insects, less so pollinators and more so like predatory insects, are going to actually end up in the field, because that's why we want them there, right? And so something that we do is we actually interplant these species. So alyssum, dill, and cilantro are often interplanted into all of our transplant crops. And the way we do that is every time you're going to plant a transplant and you have a miss or a plant doesn't go in correctly, the crew will actually pull it and put a flower in instead. And it creates this hopscotch ability for these insects. So not only can they exist on the borders and move in about 250 feet, but if you have a planting that's a lot more than 250 feet, you still want to get to the center of that planting. And so you provide this hopscotch for these insects to harbor and to wait it out and to eat what they can, and then they can move on to the next plant. So it's this super cool, like, lily pad effect, I would say. And so I guess when you're thinking about doing that, even in like an urban environment, it's important to do it in your own yard. And then hopefully you can encourage other folks to want to do it in theirs. And so obviously flowers are beautiful and provide a lot of benefits to us as well. And so it's important to kind of integrate it into your own place and inspire that integration among other people. You can't tell them what to do, but, you know, sidewalks and medians and all of these places that could be a resource for us. I think it's really important that we kind of encourage that, I guess, on a broader scale.
Well, so what this brings up, though, is that Braga Fresh is a working farm, right? And so how do you balance decisions when you're trying to conserve biodiversity, but then also have a productive farm? So what do you think about when you do kind of your farm planning and take action as a farmer?
Yeah, of course. So one thing that we do that I think is really important is we cover crop a third of our acres every year. So when we're planning our rotations, we need to integrate that. And so it's important to understand, okay, this field is not going to be available for a few months over the winter because we are going to be cover cropping it. Unlike a lot of other agricultural production systems too, we actually grow crops year round. So some folks choose not to grow in the winter and they go all operations down to the Imperial Valley. We're going to keep crops up here. And so there's always going to be a level of biodiversity even within our cash crops. But one thing that we want to make sure we're doing is every time we disc a field or we rotate crops, we want to continue the integration of these habitats or these pollinator species. And so we keep our borders. We keep these flowers on the border. We keep these large acreage, you know, committed areas. We keep areas around our building. And so there's always going to be something and some sort of refuge, even in the wintertime, which is super important, particularly when you're going to get hit heavy with pest pressure at the beginning of our season. You want to make sure that those predator insects are already there. Because if you start getting high levels of pest populations and you have nothing to attack it, then what was the point, right? So it's really important to just make sure that we're managing year-round.
Do you see these practices being adopted more readily throughout the Salinas area and other agricultural operations?
I would say so, yeah. So we're getting a lot of interest from other growers in our habitat and how we implemented our habitat, and a lot of interest in how to manage it as well. And there are other growers that have been doing it for as long as we have. So it is a really more common practice. That being said, there's a lot of growth that can be done around this topic. Just like cover cropping, it's underutilized and really, really effective. So I would say that in the last 3 years, there's been a massive uptick in people's interest in integrating habitat into the Salinas Valley.
I have kind of a philosophical question. What have the bees taught you that translates to how you live your life?
Ooh, I like that. I think like the whole importance of the greater good has been really impactful for me. Being a super organism, I think a lot of people think that the queen bee is the most important and that all of the bees serve her. And when you really start to recognize their behavior and look into the dynamic of a hive. That's not really the case. She's just like any other bee. She's different in her, you know, physiological makeup. That being said, if she's not doing her job effectively, they will replace her in an instant. And so this idea of she has all the power and we think that everyone is praising her, but really they're all making sure that she is serving them as a population. It's like this really effective democracy that I think we would really benefit from trying to emulate.
Okay, so speaking of bee democracies, imagine all the bees came together and they took a vote and they decided you're their spokesperson. What would you like to say on behalf of bees that is maybe a misconception or things that everyone should know about bees?
They're not going to sting you if you leave them alone. So I often see more so adults than children who see a bee and start swatting in the air. Horrible idea. If you want to get stung, swat at a bee. I mean, just like any insect, if you're going to swat at it, you're very large and it is very small. So yeah, it's going to protect itself. That being said, you could have thousands of bees flying around you. I've been in an apiary with zero protection on my face or hands or anything, and I didn't get stung because they're not there to sting me. So I think that that's really important, really low-hanging fruit. Don't swat at bees. Just let them be, right? I guess the other thing would be, I think that we tend to focus a lot on industrial agriculture and not necessarily on what the individual can do. And so there are all sorts of initiatives out there to keep industrial agriculture responsible, to make sure that we're reducing our inputs, to make sure that we're using organic inputs when possible. And that's something that we're doing, you know, day to day, and we're managing our landscapes and on a broad scale. But something we're not focusing on is what people are putting in their yards and on their lawns and on their golf courses and all of these places where pesticide use is very heavy and maybe not as necessary as our food system, right? We need to feed the world. That being said, your garden is feeding your family, and that's wonderful. Try to do it organically if you can, I would say.
What's your favorite bee fun fact that you like to drop on people at parties?
Well, let's see. Do you know how much honey a bee produces in her entire lifetime? 1/12 of a teaspoon. 1/12 of a teaspoon, that's a little dot. Do you know how long a bee lives? 4 to 6 weeks. But a queen can live up to 4 years.
Wow. Our minds are melting.
I know. A queen bee can choose the sex of every single offspring that she lays based on either brushing the egg past the sperm sac or not. So if she fertilizes the egg with sperm, then she creates a worker bee. If she does not fertilize the egg, she creates a drone bee, which is a male.
Haploid.
Yes.
Okay, so traditionally, a lot of creatures are diploid, which means you have two sets of chromosomes. And haploid means half of that initially, so it's really only one set of chromosomes. So the male bees, they don't have that genetic input from the paternal side. They only have it from the queen.
Yep, that was exactly it.
I know that a lot of honeys have different flavors depending on the input source. So do you have a favorite honey? And can you talk a little bit about where that kind of flavor profile diversity comes from?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the diversity in honey is actually seasonality. So particularly if you're taking your hive and moving it to different cropping systems, you're going to get very different honeys. So in our area, generally a honey harvested after spring is going to be high viscosity and light in color. So it has a really high nectar content. It's really kind of a sweeter honey, whereas a lot of the honey that you get in the grocery store is more of a fall honey. So it's thicker and darker. I find that little kids really, really like spring honeys because they're like cotton candy sometimes, like intensely sweet. And they tend to keep their like viscosity easier, whereas a fall honey will crystallize very quickly in your cabinet. That being said, if you ever have honey that crystallizes, don't put it in the microwave or heat it up because you're actually going to change the kind of chemistry of the honey. You just want to put the jar into like a bowl of hot water to get that liquid content back.
If I'm in the grocery store, what do I look for so I know that I'm looking at a Braga Fresh product?
Our organic label is Josie's Organics. It's really popular. You'll see it around in all sorts of grocery chains. As for our Braga Fresh label, our product travels very well. So we're often seen on the East Coast. Under a Braga Fresh label, it's a big blue label. It says Braga on it. It's got a cute little green plant on there. And we also do a lot of store brand stuff. So you're often eating a Braga product and you wouldn't even know it unless you know how to read a SKU. BFG1, that's us.
Thanks for listening to this week's Voices of the Valley. Today's episode was produced by Kara Timmon. We'd like to give a huge thanks to Katie Chiapuzio for joining us and sharing her expertise on honeybees. In our next episode of Voices of the Valley, we'll be joined by Western growers Sonia Salas and Joel Masso, both Associate Vice Presidents of Science for Western Growers, to talk about food safety. Sonia and Joel are more than just scientists. They're also mothers who work tirelessly to ensure a safe and secure food supply for all who enjoy fresh produce. We have a lot more in store for this season of Voices of the Valley, so make sure you tune in each week and join us as we explore more about farming and our food system with some of the most well-respected experts in the industry. If you enjoyed our podcast today, be sure to follow us on X. Leave a comment and let us know your thoughts. We'll be selecting a few lucky recipients to receive a coveted Western Growers branded Stanley mug. You can find us at our handle, @WesternGrowers. And don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss any of our future episodes. That does it for this week's Voices of the Valley. I'm Corey Lundy, signing off. See you next week. Thanks for tuning in to Voices of the Valley, a Western Growers production, produced by Corey Lundy, Ann Donahue, Michelle Rivera, Kara Timmons, and Julia Nellis. As always, we'd like to give a special shout out to our guest for joining us. Don't forget to like and subscribe to catch our future episodes, and we invite you to follow us on social media to continue the conversation.